Hello and welcome to Share Talk. This is Peter Higgins at Conker's Corner. Today I've got Jonathan Curry with me. Jonathan Curry is a company director. He's been angel investing for over 20 odd years now. He's an equity investor and he's also a part-time investor. And Jonathan previously has shared some of his knowledge and articles that we've published. Jonathan is an entrepreneur, although he's very humble and doesn't want to talk about that very much. Hello, Jonathan. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. Good afternoon to you.
Good to hear from you, mate. The last time we spoke, we were at the Master Investor Show where we had Weedy Dealer and the cohort Share Talk mob all discussing shares, which I know you enjoyed.
Oh, great fun. Right. I mean, it's always very useful to get other people's opinions. You know, when you're investing, it can get quite a insular task and you can get very set on your thoughts rather than what's actually happening.
Very, 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 very true. Now, Jonathan, we've known each other on Twitter for a little while and we've shared information. We've conversed with lots of other people in our research. There's still a few people on Twitter that are not aware of you. So what I want you to do is firstly give you the opportunity to introduce yourself and tell people a little bit about your background, how you started, what your educational background is, and how you got interested or when you got interested in shares, investing, trading, etc., if you'd be so kind.
I started buying shares when I was sort of a teenager.
Okay.
I mean, my father, you know, used to buy and sell shares, and he sort of explained to me that shares are one of the few ways you can get rich by somebody else does all the work.
That's good. I like that.
So he, you know, so at quite an early age, he encouraged myself and my brothers to sort of look at shares in the stock market, and if you had a little bit of money spare, and those were the days where a little bit of money was genuinely just a little bit of money.
Yes, yeah.
You know, he sort of put me in with his broker. And those were the days when, you know, it was done over a telephone call.
Yeah.
And people knew who you were talking to. And when you called them up, there wasn't a series of passwords. There were, hello, I'm Jonathan Curry.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, can I speak to Steve? And when you spoke to Steve, you said, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I bought one or two sort of investment trusts. And it was really on the ground that you can get rich out of somebody else working, or you can get wealthier off somebody else working. And if you pick the right people, they'll work very hard for you for a long period of time.
It's very, very good. Very good views to look there, and very good ideology as well. So when were you? When did you make your first purchase? How old were you? A teenager.
I guess I was sort of 17, 16, 17, 17, 18.
Very good start.
It was. I mean, you did need an adult, as in
of
my
course,
case,
of course,
sort of get you a brokerage account at the time. I mean, it wasn't just something you could phone up saying, "I'm a snotty school kid, and I fancy some shares." You did need a grown-up to sort of verify who you were.
Of course, yes.
You needed money in the account. There was none of, I mean, I'm sure if you're an adult, they probably would have, but as a child, effectively, you needed to have the money in the account to buy the shares.
Of course.
But this was, you know, well, it still is the case. You had X number of days to settle and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So I did it, you know, in a very mild way for quite a while with, you know, mixed level of success, sort of learning experience, put it that way.
Yeah, of course. So were you in the same sort of situation with similar to our good friend Diana Patterson, where you'd pick and choose and then send your purchases or your sales certificates back through the post? Are you that early?
Yeah, I had share certificates. In the good old days, you had share certificates. And when you bought shares, you got one sent to you. And when you sold shares, you sent them back.
Indeed. Brilliant days. And I had a few discussions with some other people that I've interviewed. And we've come to the conclusion that whilst it's great to have these online accounts, we tend to overtrade now because the certificates, because you can see them, you're less reluctant to part with them. Whereas when it's an online account, it's like, oh, that's happened today. And we accelerate the selling process, don't we, or the buying process. We don't take
Absolutely
as long to research.
True. I mean, the big win is things are a lot cheaper to do than they used to be.
Yeah.
You know, the reality is that the spreads have come down massively. The spreads have come down massively and the charges from your broker have come down massively. the big loss is it becomes incredibly easy to trade. And I'm sure a lot of us, myself included, overtrade because it's so easy to do.
Yeah, I'll hold my hand up with that one, definitely.
I mean, in the old days, you know, if you called up, I mean, I guess if a broker didn't want to trade because the market was busy, like just after Brexit.
Yeah.
I mean, he basically didn't pick up the phone.
Well, quite a lot of people had difficulties on that Friday morning after Brexit, mate, where lots of significantly large platforms, I won't name any of them, they couldn't trade. They couldn't get access to their accounts. And then it was like, oh, we're struggling with the volume today. So, and then people that wanted to trade at that price found out, you know, 30 seconds later that the price has gone down 25%.
Well, I think there is to some extent some truth in the issues that people raise about high frequency trading. It doesn't normally apply to investors like myself, because normally I'm looking for a price to enter and a price to exit.
Yeah.
And as long as I've hit those two buttons, that's very true. But when you have high frequency trading and they are front running accounts, then the reality is that if you come onto a market and try and buy something, they know as you're putting those orders in and you're trying to say, this is what I'm interested in doing, particularly if like me, you're asking for a price. Then they're in the market before you are or ahead of you, and they are basically shifting the price against you.
Yeah.
Whether you want to go in or you want to go out.
That's often the case, yeah.
And so in periods of high volatility, I think there's a lot of truth in the fact that, you know, the high frequency trading market doesn't really add anything. I mean, they claim to add liquidity, but by and large, what they're doing is picking up the shares that you were intending to buy and then selling them to you. So there's an extra buy and sell in the process.
Very true, yeah.
So, yes, I think on days like Brexit, a lot of guys and girls, us private investors got on the wrong side of high frequency trading. And we had people who were trying to make markets where they didn't know what price they wanted to put things out, which is partially why you've now got the rebound. These guys have just, you know, if you actually try and buy something, and there was one or two things I try to buy and one or three things I try to sell, and the prices were moving all over the shop. At one stage, I even put in a buy and sell through two different brokers. One I bought, one I sold, the same share. And actually, I didn't end up with any.
Oh, wow.
The sell moved out on the price that I was preparing.
Yeah,
I moved in.
Yeah, it's crazy. Crazy markets. That was
so, you know, there's an element of, you know, we are little people in the market.
Yeah.
And sometimes when things are being played by the big boys, you either get squashed or you stand aside.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's very true. Sometimes it's better to just let them get on with it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay then, Jonathan. So you started at 16, 17. What was your background then? Were you studying a particular field at the time? Did you go to university, do anything?
I was at school.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just a muppet. not so much story talks, but things like investment trust. I understood, my father had done enough to explain to me certain principles of business.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, unit trust, investment trust, and the difference between them, and the fact that investment trust often were cheaper.
Yeah.
That you know, that they don't close down because you're selling the shares, not the units within them and all those sort of things. So most of what I was buying was investment trusts. And most of the investment trusts I was buying were based on past performance.
Yeah.
And sort of some story stock idea about the future. So, you know, Fleming Chinese Investment Trust. Mm-hmm. You know, China, 30 years ago, China was going to be the great success.
Of course.
And it's still yet to deliver.
And Japan similarly with that as well, and Russia, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, there was, back then, there used to be a number of directed dealing investment trusts.
Remember them, yeah.
And, you know, I had one or two of those, and they were, you know, equally bad for me as some of the other ideas I had.
Right.
So, but I can understand the principle. I can understand the principle. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of money. So my mistakes were painful in, you know, to me at the time, but in absolute terms, It was a cheap way to learn.
Learn, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've had two wonderful conversations. One with Annabelle Brody-Smith, who's in charge of training for AIC regarding Association of Investment Companies, and Nick Britton as well of AIC, and they cover the length and breadth of the investment trust industry. And they were talking about the dividend heroes, such as City of London, that have been paying dividends that have increased over 50 years, you know. So the list of investment trusts that have had long-term managers that have performed really, really well have served, you know, long-term investors really, really well. So if you were fortunate enough to have picked some others other than Fleming and China and Japan, you'd have done exceptionally well if you'd held them.
Yeah, I mean, I am a fan of time in the market rather than timing the market. I think that it's a hiding to nothing. But I think it's also very true that a lot of these statistics that people use to validate a lot of these things are not selective, but very situationally relevant.
Right.
It's take the American market. There's 14, somebody's done some study of the last 5 to 10 years of the American market. And there's 14,311 shares on NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange over that time.
Right, okay.
The market has increased, compound increase in the market, I think, is a bit over 10% over the last 15 years. But when you go underneath that, only 20% of the shares have actually increased in price over that time, once you adjust for inflation.
Yeah.
40% of the shares have actually fallen in price over that time, and 40% have really gone nowhere.
Yeah.
So a lot of this, if you buy this or if you buy that, it depends very much on the day you buy this or the day you buy that, and the period over which you want to measure your hold,
and also the individual companies that you've picked and selected.
Because, sorry to interrupt you, but the
thing is about the American market, much the same as ours, is that there's certain companies that drag the whole sector or the whole FTSE up. Because there's such large movers, large market cap companies such as Apple, Amazon, Google, and the like. And in the UK, you know, Royal Dutch Shell, the banks shift the whole market once they're moving.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so you've been trading now since 16. You've learned a lot of lessons, even though you started in the investment trust side of things and a few different equities. Yeah, so you've invariably experienced the tech boom and bust, 2007, 2008, 2009, and the recent dips, as people are now calling them, although they were calling them crashes of the 20s, the 2000s, should I say. So what attracted you to the arena other than your dad saying getting other people to work for you to earn you a little bit of extra crust?
Well, I am an accountant by training.
Right, excellent.
After university, I mean, I had no idea what I wanted to do at university, so I went to university to have fun. Had some fun.
Yeah.
Came out of university, had no idea what I wanted to do as a grown-up job.
Right, your qualification was in economics?
I did politics.
Politics, right, okay.
No lectures before 10:30. No lectures.
Is that why you picked politics then, Jonathan?
It certainly, in all honesty, it didn't hurt. It didn't hurt. Economics was 9 o'clock.
Oh dear.
Any lectures?
I find that so funny. Right, 10:30 start. Brilliant.
Once you get to your, I don't know how some people do. I mean, some people are very grown up. They have a mission. They know where they're going.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. I didn't. Yeah. I mean, I thought, you know, university gives you another 3 years to work out what you want to do.
Fair play, yeah.
Gives you a chance to grow up a bit.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting for that. But it was simply, you know, I did university, get to the end of university, and then I was looking at very different careers, one of which was accountancy, because you could sort of see that it gives you a range of skills.
Yeah.
You can always get work as an accountant.
Yeah.
Nowadays robots will take that job over. But if you go back, there's always been a chance to get work as an accountant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those jobs that once you've got that basic knowledge, you are ahead of many people when you're looking at a business and trying to understand what's happened.
Of course, you need to bear down on all the different metrics.
Yeah, so I did accountancy for some years, and after that, you do have a sort of range of knowledge that you can then begin to apply. I mean, I can look at a company's accounts and have a reasonable idea as to what is happening in that business, particularly if you get 1 or 2 years together. I mean, I think I've always said that I can fake, as a company director and finance director, I can fake any company's numbers for 2 years. But it's very hard to fake it for three. Not impossible, but you then start getting into mass collusions to fake numbers for 3 years. You really need the auditors to be corrupt as well.
We're going into Enron territory there, though, aren't we? You know.
Well, was Enron actually wrong in terms of the American regulations?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, my concern with the Enron situation was the fact that they were in collusion with their accountants, weren't they? Or am I reading that wrong?
Well, I think there's absolutely no doubt that the partners responsible for doing that audit had got to the point where if anyone put something in front of them, they were inclined to sign it.
Yeah.
Agreed. I think that seems to have been some truth. Yeah. But my understanding is Enron started to unwind because America has some very... It's like if you write something down in a rule book, a guy will look for a way around it.
Of course, yeah.
Or some people look for a way around it. And mm-hmm. American regulations, American audit regulations, and this is where everyone is now switching off from this podcast. But American audit regulations are very codified, which means if you do A, B, C, D, then you can say X.
Yeah.
And what happened is the Americans have wrote these rules, and these guys looked for the loopholes and found it. Right. So they were setting up all these special purpose vehicles, which clearly were not intended to do what it said on the tin, but technically fulfilled the regulation. And it was only when they set one of these up wrongly that the whole pack of cards came down.
Yeah.
But my understanding is, you know, very few people actually went, I mean, on the audit side, I think very few people actually ended up with any sort of penalty because technically they had followed the rules.
Mm. Yeah. I think that's the danger of having too many accountants, isn't it? Or too many tax accountants in one business because you've got one for every single issue, and to reduce to the point that, you know, there's so many large entities that pay little or no tax in the countries where they do business in.
Yeah, I mean, we've got to the point where, I mean, I understand why you have all these tax regulations and all these sort of bits and pieces, but we have got to the point where clearly certain firms are just abusing the privilege.
Yeah. Agreed. Now, as an investor, given the fact you started off in investment trusts, Jonathan, and now you've got a much broader portfolio, you've said earlier that you're a long-term investor. Would you deem yourself to be a low-risk investor, cautious, or do you have a mix of all manner of things in your portfolio at present?
I would say I try and go for value.
Yep.
But as somebody pointed out, who tells you they don't go for value? So I try and do deep value where I can see it.
Yeah.
I'm reluctant to put more than 10% of my portfolio into any one idea. So, you know, I'm not one of these guys who are going to bet everything on number six.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. But even then, to interrupt you, Jonathan, 10% in one idea does sound quite high.
I don't have that many good ideas.
Okay, fair enough. So you've got quite a condensed, a small portfolio, concentrated portfolio is the word I'm looking for, sorry.
I have quite a lot of my portfolio in a limited number.
Right, okay.
I am at the moment running a few Schloss screens.
Right, okay.
You know, based on Walter Schloss. Well,
yeah, I remember.
To some extent, you're prepared to buy anything if it's crappy enough.
Right, okay.
Or poor enough. But that's probably a polite way of putting it.
Yeah.
You look for stuff that's very much the low with a level of asset backing. Because right, I think a lot of what he says is very sensible. You know, you can manipulate profits and they can change very quickly. But it's hard to manipulate base assets.
Yeah.
Not impossible. I'll tell you how to do it if you want. But it's you know, over a period of time, it's hard to manipulate base assets. And so the reality is that at the moment I have about 30 holdings. and a number of them are sub 1%, because I'm trying out this Schloss investments, just seeing how they go.
Yeah.
At the moment, they're going great, because I bought most of them a couple of days after Brexit.
Okie dokie, that's good. Well timed.
So I bought into a few of those. So some of those I've got to come out, because I'm almost at the sort of price point I set. If they come to here, I'll sell them.
Right, okay.
But they were based on the, you know, given what that business is, given what the assets this business has got, you know, I'm not likely to lose much. And the chance for a sort of 20, 30, 40% upside seems reasonably good, so I'll buy those.
Okay, so you're using the Schloss method, but you're also looking at the cash flow and the asset backing. So you're saying that the cash flow can't be manipulated, so therefore if the asset is strong enough and it's showing consistent cash flow growth, then that would be the sort of quality companies that you're looking for that have been beaten down or are off the radar.
Well, no, there's two parts. I mean, on the Schloss thing, I'm not looking so much at the cash flow.
Right, okay.
I'm looking at the asset backing.
Right, okay.
Because I don't think he looks at... I mean, I want to check that the business is not hemorrhaging cash.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I want to make sure that it can lose a bit of cash. The cash flow can be slightly negative, I think. Because if the assets are there, you can always take out debt against the assets. Banks will lend against the building.
Yeah.
Always have, always will. So I'm looking at the asset backing, and I'm thinking I'll have some of that. Relatively, you know, the price is very low relative to where it's been. It's got asset backing relative to the share price. I'll have a bit of that. Cash will be great. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm all for that. But, I mean, my standard investment style is to try and look at businesses that I think are strong businesses with a high level of intrinsic value.
Yeah, makes sense.
Or ones where, I mean, one of the businesses I tweeted about a bit is PPHE, which is a hotel business.
Yeah, they've thrown off a special dividend, haven't they, recently?
They have.
Yeah.
They, for a long time, or for a while ago, if you started looking at them, hotel businesses have a feature where they can be called OpCo-PropCo, which is operating company, property company.
Yeah.
And the operating company runs the hotels, and the property company is essentially a property company.
Yeah.
And PPHE was always that sort of combination, but never really had the property being terribly valued. The property was always on its book at initial cost.
Yeah.
But what's happened over the last couple of years is they began to both state on their accounts, not changing the actual balance sheet, but putting a note in the account saying, if we were to, we've done a sort of valuation of this, we're not changing the balance sheet valuation, but in fact, our property is worth a lot more than the balance sheet says.
Yeah.
And nobody bought it.
Yeah, so there was essentially trading at a large dividend to the net asset value of the total assets that they had, yeah?
Yeah.
So that anomaly sat in the stock market for a little while. You spotted it and started purchasing it way below discount to now. Yeah.
And they've done some refinancing on their properties, and they're all coming into the value that they gave or better.
Yeah.
And that's what's enabled them to pay the special dividend.
Excellent.
And as that business grows, it's got quite a tight shareholding. It's owned by a company called Red Sea Group, Israeli business.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of intergroup trading, which isn't brilliant.
Yeah.
But the guys over a number of years have sort of said what they're doing, delivered all they said.
Yeah.
They've got a finance director, Stoke, was it semi-chief executive type guy, who responds to every email you send him.
Oh, okay, that's good.
So I think they're a nice little company that's been undervalued, isn't going to do, you know, has a few issues at the moment because the property in the UK, everyone's jumping around.
Yeah.
But as a hotel business, we'll benefit, I think, from the fact that we're now a lot cheaper to come and visit. So the operating company's probably got a slightly better business. The property company's probably got a slightly worse business.
Okay.
But the property company was already being undervalued. It's not going to get undervalued much more. And they have the ability to go to bank and say, okay, we have this hotel, we have this site, we'd like to draw down loans, and we'd like to recapitalise based on those loans.
Okay, well, that sounds like they've suddenly got their act together, and obviously now they're appearing on people's radar because of this dividend thing, and they're narrowing their NAV. So it looks like you're onto a winner there. So looking at your portfolio, Jonathan, as 100%, you said you've got 30-odd-ish stocks. What percentage is held in blue chips, funds, and AIM, and all share stocks?
I've got about 15% in US, large US.
Okay.
People like Apple, Markel, stuff like that.
Okay.
I've got about 15% in large blue chips, UK blue chips.
Yeah.
Persimmon, Shell, people like that.
Okay.
That's about 30% altogether.
Yep.
I've probably got about 20 to 30% in mid caps.
Yep.
You know, fairly solid mid caps. And then the rest in pond life.
Another word for pond life, please. What are we going to call them?
Smaller businesses, you know.
Fledgling companies.
People like PPHE is still a small business.
Yeah.
So PPHE is actually, you know,
they're on the AIM.
Business. Yeah. They're not going to be on anyone's international radar.
Yeah.
But they are nice little businesses. Certainly in most cases, nice little businesses where you can seriously see the business is undervalued relative to what it's got on the balance sheet and relative to the cash flows and the profit and loss.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, I mean, covering all of that then, we've spoken this about it before. You seem to cover, because you do your filter screens and all the rest of it, you don't seem to have a particular preference for a sector, or do you? Have I missed that wrong?
I'll read the set of accounts.
Yeah.
I've got a sort of semi-checklist. I try and take some of the emotions out of it.
Yeah, which is good.
So I try and do a checklist, and the key question on the checklist is, do I believe in the management? That's when I'm not doing a short screen. When I'm just doing a short screen, it's just look at the balance sheet.
Yeah.
But everything else, which is the vast majority of what I currently hold, I'm trying to read the accounts because and follow what it is that management's saying, and can I believe them when I look through the actual numbers? That's the biggie for me. Do I believe in the management? Do I believe they're trying to implement and they have a clear plan? If I read the accounts and I do not understand what the business is, I can't understand how they make money, I won't buy it.
Yeah. Saying that as well, Jonathan, are you another one that has the time and the availability to yourself to be able to attend AGMs, look these guys and ladies in the eye when they're talking at the interims and full year announcements?
No.
Right. Okay.
I don't have time to, and I'm not sure that's really that worthwhile.
Okay. I've had a few people that I've interviewed that say that swear by it, including Mark Bentley of ShareSog.
Oh yeah, no, and a lot of better investors than me think it's a really good idea.
Right. Okay. Are they better investors because they believe that?
Maybe.
Right. Okay.
To meet somebody and actually talk to them and think, gosh, yes, this is a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the best con artists are great con artists because you meet them and you think they're great guys.
Right. Okay. That's a good point. I never thought of it like that. Okay.
What's the phrase that, I mean, I can't think who said it, but somebody said, how do you define a miner? Guy with a deep hole and lies at the top.
Right. It's, okay.
You know, all of these, as a company director, if I go out to meet people, do I tell them the truth about my company or do I paint the best picture we've got? And I've seen it time and again. You don't go into the room to tell people the truth. You go into the room to paint a picture and sell your business. Now, the thing about accounts is the first part of it is the write-up by the chairman, the chief executive, the finance director about their business. And they have to talk, and they talk about what they're doing, what they did, and what their plans for the next year are. When you read the accounts, you can read what they said 2 years ago, black and white.
Yeah.
And then you can look at it, and did they do that last year? Did they do that this year? That's absolute, not facts, but there's a degree of history in it.
Yes, yeah.
I'm not that great. You know, any time a woman tells me I'm interesting, I believe them. So the idea I can sit down with and say, or I'll buy, you know, anyone who buys me a beer is my mate.
Oh, bless.
So I'm not sure I'm that great at judging people.
Right, okie dokie.
But through the accounts, there's an absolute history of what you said and what you did.
Yeah.
And they would say, you know, don't buy into people because of what they say. Buy into people because of what they do.
What they do. I completely appreciate what you just said. The last sentence there. Yeah, from experience as well, I would completely agree with that statement. Yeah, it's all about what you do. Lots of people have ideas and goals that they want to accomplish, and things they say, and you know, oh Pete, I'll do this and I'll do that, and they never get round to it somehow. There's always another thing and a reason why they haven't got round to doing it. And yeah, I completely agree with you. And we met Jonathan at the Master Investor Show, and it was a fantastic meeting. We met lots of people there. We had lots of different discussions, and we were like, it was like a family outing, wasn't it? And the camaraderie was fantastic. And then a week later, some individuals imploded, and it was like, what's gone on there? What's happened in the last week? You know, and they didn't want to know each other. It's like, oh, right, okay. You know, so yeah, it does. But it's good that we've got the cohort still intact, minus a few people. But yeah, I think it is to do with strength of character and having humility and being honest with people and, you know, showing a bit of kindness, I think. That's why I'm a big fan of mindfulness. You know, see what you're doing, you do what you're going to do, and you're open and candid with people all the while. You know?
Yeah, but, you know, I know that you do help a lot of people on Twitter and also via direct message and email and things like that. It's the guys who get out, or the people, not the guys, that's very sexist nowadays. Yeah. But it's the people who get out and try and help people.
Yeah.
You've got time for. It's the people who are in it for themselves. It's you know, you've got less time for. But it's hard to judge those. I find it hard to judge.
I do as well, mate. But it's over time that people prove themselves. And I think I give everyone an opportunity to prove themselves. It's not really necessarily about proving themselves to me. It's about, I'm showing you my honesty and my integrity. I'm giving you this, and I'll keep giving it to you. All I'm wanting to see is whether or not you pass that forward to somebody else, not necessarily give it back to me, or give me something. I'm doing this for you, so you have to do something for me. That's not what I'm about. I'm seeing whether Jonathan Curry or Wheelie Dealer or Diana Patterson is going to pass it forward to somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, and it's very much that. But like you said, we had that meeting and a lot of us got on, but then some people decided to take a slightly different route.
Yeah.
Or amazing different, but that's partly down to it.
That's part of the way of life, yeah.
It's possible, but also we all met and we all got on fine, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, we did.
And so that's the truth of most of these things. I'm not a great judge of character, or I wouldn't claim to be a great judge of character, and therefore meeting management to me is interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would turn down the opportunity.
Yeah.
But by and large, it's not a big part of my investment strategy because I don't believe I have the skills to be that good a judge of people.
Right, okay.
But I can read what you told me you'd do 3 years ago, and then I can see whether you did it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that.
And if you didn't do it, why didn't you do it?
Yeah, yeah.
Or are you one of those people who tend to, you know, oh, there's nothing to look at back there. Forget last year. I'm just going to write something completely different.
Yeah, yeah. Which happens, and we had a discussion with somebody else about the fact you have to read all these RNSs, and there's one individual that went back, I think it was six years of RNSs would go through, you know, which I found absolutely staggering, but that's what works for him, because he's saying you need to make sure that the management are being consistent with what they're saying and what they're doing. So that just sits exactly with what you're saying. In fact, that person was Phil Oakley.
Yeah.
Of ShareScope. Yeah.
Absolutely. You can sit down. I mean, I keep records of the companies that I'm sort of looking at. I print off most of their RNSs, certainly the key ones. I look at them on Google Alerts, and you just build up a number of years of thinking, actually, these guys tell the truth.
Yeah.
Or you build up a packet of, well, actually, these people, mm-hmm. they've got more grey in their lives than I want to live with.
Okay. So this is a really, really important point, and somebody raised this with me a couple of weeks ago, and I've added it into my list of questions. Given what you're doing now, Jonathan, how much time do you spend researching a particular stock before you get to the point of thinking, right, okay, I've monitored this, I've watched it, I've researched it, it's now fallen into my buy zone, I'm going to buy it. What sort of time frame are we talking?
I will try. As I said, I'm running sort of two different methods at the moment. If I'm running the Schloss screen,
yep.
and it bangs through there, I want to grab the last set of accounts and look at those.
Mm-hmm.
Once I've got that, you know, if I'm at work, then I can't do it because I'm just, you know, there's things on. I can't just sit and take it. But if I can do that fairly quick, you can do that in sort of an hour or so.
Okay.
I might come buy that the next day if the price is still down where it was.
Okay, and you're on the screen. Yep.
Normally, I'm trying to look through the last 3 years' accounts and the interims. And that's probably a week. Just give the time I've got available. I'm sure you could do it in a day.
Yeah.
But just wading through accounts and accounts and accounts, it all begins to glaze over. And you're trying to think, which year was that?
Indeed.
So I tend to, you know, if I'm interested in a company, I tend to take a week. But most things on my watch list have been on my watch list for, 8, 9, 10, 12 months.
Okay.
And I haven't formed a price on them. It's a lot easier to get off my watch list than it is to get onto it. But once it's on it, I'll follow it for a couple of years because I don't think firms necessarily plateau on a price. You know, I mean, one I've got is a company called NCC.
Mm-hmm.
I first bought into that, and I think I set a price. I can't remember what it was, but I'm just going to pick numbers here. I think I first set a price of about £1 for it, and it went up. And so I set a price of £1.50. When it sort of got to £1, I looked at it again and thought, actually, this business is going forward. And I think I went through £2.50,
£3.50.
Looking at my screen now, I've got a sell point at £3.80. If it goes to £3.80 tomorrow, I'll sell it.
Or I
might raise it to £4. But most of my shares takes a while to get into. I'm quite happy to hold them for till they reach the sort of price point that I'm aiming for, and then I'll flog it and move on.
Okay. So over the course of the week, then you're looking at a couple of hours each day, and then you get to the point. So you could easily say it's over 10 hours before you get to the point of thinking, right, okay, I've done enough research on this particular stock. I've tracked it for 9 months, and then I'm going to go and buy this. Yeah, is that fair enough? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Cumulatively over a period of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Easily. I'll spend that because one of the other things I'm trying to do is, accepting that I'm not an expert, I do try and find out if other people think it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And that can take a while. You've got to often sort of pull all sorts of bits and pieces to try and find who's written about this business.
Yes, of course, yeah.
There's a lot of free stuff out there.
Yeah, and that's I know how you do it, Jonathan, and it's similar to myself. You have to look at the bear points, not just the bullish points about the company as well. Whereas some people with cognitive dissonance just go and choose and find all the stuff that resonates with them as the reasons to buy it and not look at the negatives as the reasons why they shouldn't buy it.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I'm going to push on now and ask you the greatest lessons you've attained since you started investing at 16, Jonathan.
Don't look at the price. Don't look at the price every day.
Yep.
Staring
at screens, yeah.
I think for me, people invest, there's 1,001 ways to do this well. And I've only got the one that I'm doing. And it may not even be the right one for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly probably not the right one for anyone else. There are hundreds and hundreds of different ways to be successful in investing and trading. So it's entirely up to people how they do it. But for me, I've learned that looking at the price every day is not a great use of my time.
Of course.
Or likely to make me more sensible.
Yeah.
What I try and do is I have an entry price, which is essentially where I buy the shares and I'm prepared to buy more. I have an exit price, which is where I should be prepared to sell the shares and move on.
Yeah.
And in between those two things, all I should really be doing is reading the accounts and other RNSs and adjusting potentially my exit price based on what they say.
Yeah.
Or a very occasionally, I mean, I did have an investment in a share who I will mention if you want, but essentially I've read their accounts a couple of times. But then one set of accounts just seemed to say we as management have so many reasons to do what is not in the interest of shareholders.
Oh dear. Right.
That we will do it.
Right.
I thought, this is insane.
Mm.
The business is worth more than it is on the day I sold it. I'm sure it is. Even with nuts. incentives for the management.
Yeah.
But having said that, I thought, I just don't want to be part of that.
No, I understand that.
Any business that says to the management, gear this business up because it's in your interest to gear it up because we're going to ignore interest costs for your profit bonus schemes. I just read there's about three or four things in that in one of their sets of accounts. I just thought, this is just nuts.
Yeah. This is the beauty of paying attention to detail, isn't it? And occasionally, you know, we all do it. We miss these red flags sometimes that we have to question and raise and say, hey, that doesn't make sense. And if it doesn't make sense, then why should I be involved with it? Like you say, but you have to be on your game. You know, you have to be reading these things and not just looking at the nice, you know, positives that they put at the top of the RNSs or the first two paragraphs. It's like, we're doing absolutely great, guys, blah, blah, blah. And then you get further down. It's like, however, you know, that bit at the bottom that spooks everybody.
Yeah. So I saw that in a business that I'd been in for a while. I hadn't seen that before. Now, maybe it wasn't in previous sets of accounts.
Yeah.
But when I read it, I put it down and read it again the sort of next day and said, oh, this is just nuts from my perspective. So thank you very much. I'm out.
No, I get that. There's a great quote by Lao Tzu, a Shaolin monk that I love, founder of Taoism. Knowing others is intelligence. Knowing yourself is true wisdom. Mastering others is strength, and mastering yourself is true power. So what you've done is that you've taken over the course of the years, you've learned and you've nurtured all the things that you've put together to invest and trade. And now you've got to the point where these red flags just jump out for you out of RNSs. But for other people, they're still learning that, aren't they? So that's the power of your knowledge now, is that you see the red flags that other people don't see, Jonathan.
I see some red flags.
You see some red flags, sorry. I'm probably giving you too much praise there.
No. Other people have different systems.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say I'm not a trader. But clearly there are a lot of people who are traders, and they do it very well.
Yeah.
And they make a lot of money. And some of them, you know, some of them are into the, look, I've seen this triple head candle picture jobby, and I'm off. It's a rising spinet top doji butterfly, and that means that you buy and chuck it 20% up.
Technical, don't mock technical analysis, please, Jonathan. Come on. It's there for a purpose, mate. It works. It's not the only element that you can use. Sorry? You're leaving the room.
It works. It works
because
I've told a few business. I think I've told maybe even you, but yeah. I went to an FX presentation by one of the banks that I work with, and they had a guy stood up and talked about the economics of, it was a couple of months ago, talked about the economics of the, you know, the cable, which pound, dollar, and all those sort of other bits and pieces. And then they got a trader. And his head of their trading desk at this bank, or deputy head of trading desk, and he said, look, I don't understand any of that. None of that makes a pot of difference to me. He said, 90% of the people buying and selling currency have no need of it. They are just traders like me.
Yeah.
And what we do is we look at these charts, and we look at Fibonacci retrenchments and all those little bits and pieces. He says, and we trade based on what the picture is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's nothing fundamental to it. And they're all looking at all these charts. And he says, this is why charts are powerful. He says, I don't realize. He says, I can explain Fibonacci retrenchments, but I don't need to understand it. All I need to know is that the rest of the market is looking for the Fibonacci retrenchment, and they'd all start selling when it hits this number.
Yeah, very true.
So he says, so in terms of currency, there's nothing fundamental in the way we trade. We just look at the way everyone else is doing it, and then we just flog around based on that picture. So I understand the power of charts, because if everyone is following the chart, inherently it becomes powerful.
Yeah, because they're all looking for the same metrics, aren't they? Oh, sorry, a lot of them are looking for the same metrics.
Yeah, so I don't get me wrong, I'm not going to try and stand in the way of a chart, because, you know, the market will bulldoze me.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, time in the market rather than timing the market.
Yeah, agreed.
Spotting, you know... I know more about charts now than I ever have before, based on that, you know, that first meeting with the guy from the bank.
Yeah.
Because he said, doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong, everyone else is following it, so you'll just get bulldozed. I don't care whether you think you're clever, Mr. Curry. So, fair enough.
Fair enough.
He's right.
Yeah.
So I don't knock it, and it absolutely works for a lot of people. But I'm trying to look for deep value, and therefore I am trying by and large to say, okay, buy this, you know, it's a worth a pound, but I can buy it for 50p today, and at some time in the next 3-4 years, the rest of the market will work up to the fact it's worth a pound.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always good to buy something that's undervalued.
Yeah,
most definitely. Jonathan, what's been your wisest investment decision to date, other than not staring at screens all day and being out and about?
I think the wisest thing I've learned is there is a time to sell. I mean, the two things I think I've learned certainly in the last few years, I think, really, is I used to be a big buy and hold.
Yeah.
But if you buy and hold most things over, not 2-3 years, but, you know, you start holding things. Most businesses have a time when they're great, and then they reach a point where they stop being as great as they were. You know, nobody can compound exponentially forever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at Warren Buffett, possibly the world's greatest investor. But if you look at many of his big holdings, they've been an absolute disaster for the last few years. You know, American Express. Great idea when he did it, but where's that gone in the last 5 to 10 years? Mm-hmm. You know, he sold out of the newspaper business.
Yeah.
Tesco's, what investment for him? Mm-hmm. So the reality is, I think for the small guys like me, you've got to have some idea of an exit point. Now, as I said earlier, with NCC, I keep on moving my exit point up.
Yeah.
But most of the other things I've held, there comes to a point where I say, fundamentally, this has become valued at what I think it's worth. So I'll take the money and walk away.
And look at something else, yeah.
You know, not just carry on holding it, because they go up and then they go down. And you think, well, that was a great idea. You know, I don't like the down bit. So I think being prepared to accept that that's the price that you put in your, in my case, on my spreadsheet, and that's the price I'll take and walk away.
No, that's a fair point. I think the thing about Buffett is that, given the fact he's been in certain stocks for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, is that the nominal price that he's paid is sometimes 15 times less than what it is currently, and therefore the dividend yield he's getting is astronomical. The stocks that he's holding now, certain stocks, that are paying him 25%, 30% yield, you know, where else can you get that? Even if the fact that the stock's gone nowhere for 5 years, and it stays stationary, for the next 5 years, he's getting 30% dividend. So every 3 years, he's doubling the value of whatever he purchased it at originally.
Yeah, but he's the reason he can't sell people like American Express is if he sold it... Sorry, bear me a second.
That's a very nice ringtone you've got there, Jonathan.
Yeah. The reason he can't sell American Express is the tax bill.
Right. Okay.
I think he's caught in some things. He can't. He's a wiser man than me, so.
But surely, Jonathan, at Berkshire Hathaway, he's got a whole team of accountants that could, you know, I'm not sure the American public would love it. Would love the fact that they see him paying as little tax as possible. You know, he gives so much away. He's got a team of accountants that can reduce his tax bill to little or nothing if necessary. We were just talking about Warren Buffett having, you know, X amount of accountants, and if he could and he wished to, he could reduce his tax bill. However, as you were saying, that if he sold the likes of American Express, it wouldn't quite work that way because of the tax bill, you were saying.
I think he has a public reputation.
Yeah, to uphold, yeah.
To uphold. So I think mass avoidance of tax is probably not something he would regard as a sensible or required for him to do.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, we will find out in 10 years, when he has, let's hope it's a long time away, but when he does finally leave this Berkshire Hathaway and somebody else is running the business, we will see what they continue to do, whether they just continue to hold Amex because of the historical yield. I'm not sure they will. I'm not sure they won't. They're not asking me what to do, so I wouldn't worry about it too much.
No, I think you've made some valid points there, mate. I think that the concern for a lot of people is that on the rare occasions that he's come out and he said, you know, and the RNSs, as whatever they call them over there, are out, and he says that he's bought certain stock. A lot of people now are waiting 3 months before they follow him into the stock, because the last, you know, 2 years, the stuff that he's bought haven't done so well. I think the classic one is IBM was the last big purchase he made. Didn't do so well. However, when he says he's trimmed or he's reduced certain stocks, people are like, whoa, okay. For him to have made that call on that company, you know, they're wanting to exit straight away, because they know that there's large volume of shares that he's got to get rid of, or may continue to get rid of, is going to impact the share price. And the most recent purchase he made has been Apple, and that just about stabilized Apple around the $90 mark. But it hasn't moved that significantly ahead of that.
No.
So, tell me about it. Yeah. Sorry, but you're not saying that because you hold it, Jonathan. I do apologize. right. So given the many lessons that you've learned since you started investing, Jonathan, which one, other than the ones you've touched on already, would you most wish to share with our audience and listeners of the many lessons?
I think any investor needs to understand what strategy works for them.
Yeah.
And to some extent, and by and large, stick to it.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to be absolutely rigorous about it. I mean, I know a number of people seem to have, this is what I do with 80% of my money or 90% of my money, but 10% is for story stocks or for taking a flutter.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But I think for most investors, you have to have, this is what I'm going to do and I'm going to stick with it. If you look at any long-term investor, any of the people who've got, you know, Howard Marks, Warren Buffett, Seth Klarman, all you know, Bruce Greenwald, all these ultra-successful investors,
yeah,
they have good years and they have bad years.
Of course.
So nobody has a good year every year, except some of the people you find on Twitter and the internet.
You mean those that lack humility and never talk about the shares that have actually done wrong or done badly?
Yeah, there's a few people I follow who never seem to have had a bad idea.
Ugh.
But they could, maybe they tell the truth. I'm not saying they're not, but by and large, most of the very successful investors have bad years. But because they follow a system that works for them, they have sufficiently good years that they've become a very successful, world-famous investor.
Yeah.
So I think you've got to largely stick to your knitting.
Yeah.
Not go too far off. That's like, I mean, I don't think a Schloss Green is that far away from a deep value sort of go up growth at a reasonable price type investment, which is what I've done mostly. I mean, there are variations. I think that, was it James O'Shaughnessy?
Yeah.
Has recently written quite a lot on deep value investing with a momentum bent.
Right. Okay. Tiny slants. Yeah.
Yeah, as he's saying, if you can actually do mostly deep value, but if you actually look for the deep value shares that have already got some momentum, or the value shares probably, because they're probably no longer deep, but the value shares that have got momentum, that is in fact is proving to be better in this current market.
Right, okay.
So he's not moving massively away, mm-hmm. but he's moved away from just a pure deep value look. I think if people can do that, but mm-hmm. the people who change their strategy week after week after week, are just going to get killed.
Yeah.
You know, you always sell. It's all this buy high, sell low stuff.
Well, they're looking for the next best thing or the noisiest stocks that are around. You know what I mean? All the while, it's about this stock's being talked about by this person and that person, and you know the individuals that are there, and you see the same group of people talking about the same stocks, and it's like a coordinated move to just get this share price moving by 3%, 4%, 5%, 10%. And then they leave people hanging and never tell them when they've sold out.
There's that. But also, there's a lot of strangeness in the financial markets. I mean, I have a friend who is... He's now working for another bank. He used to be working quite closely for a very large American bank. And one of the things he was explaining to me is that at the end of the... They have to report quarterly on their results and things like that. And they have to report on the holdings they have and all that sort of stuff. And the reality is in America, they follow the shares very closely. And last year, second half of last year, I think Activision Blizzard, Amazon, and Netflix, just those three companies, were 60% of the improvement in the American Stock Exchange.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that I've posted recently about the herding mentality of fund managers and all the rest of it. regarding Valiant is a prime example. And that's what happens, unfortunately, is that the stocks that are in vogue get, you know, it's the hotel mentality that everyone goes to the same hotel, they're staying in the same place, you know, and they're all over it until it's not the case, and then they're all rushing for the exit. So yeah, I can understand that.
Well, these guys, what he was explaining to me is because the market became aware that these were the three fantastic shares for the year, and because as a fund manager, you're not paid to be a good investor, you're paid to be a good marketer.
Yeah, yeah.
So what they did was everyone basically had to buy these shares for the end of the quarter or the end of the half year. So they could basically write saying, you may know that over the last 6 months, these have been the best performing shares in the US market by blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
We are pleased to inform you that we held those three shares.
Yes.
They're careful about the words they use. They don't say we hold those three shares for the entire 6 months.
Yeah.
Because they only bought them on the 28th of December. But they'd like to be able to say to people, actually, these are the fantastic shares and we're holding them at this point in time. And he said, you know, and it happens, he says, if you've got one of these goers, you get so much momentum put into it because all of these guys have got to hold the share so that they can say to people, oh, we haven't missed the boat.
Yeah.
And the results may prove differently because, of course, they haven't got this great growth of the last 6 months because they didn't hold them at the beginning. But he was explaining that, yeah, as a fund manager, when you've got to report each quarter, I mean, in some of these banks, you've got to report daily to your bosses what you've done that day. Everyone's terrified for their job. There's so much money on the line that they do very, very bizarre things. And as a small investor, you've got to basically accept that the market would occasionally do very strange things that you just have to ignore and float on your little boat.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think the difficulty is that with certain investors or their methodology, is that as soon as there is a little bit of noise, and I call it noise politely, is that they're out. You know, and equally, if there's a bit of noise about a stock, they're in. And they haven't done their research. So they get pulled from pillar to post. And invariably, that churning effect means that their portfolio doesn't grow over the long term. And they get impacted by costs and just selling at the low and buying at the high.
Yeah, you get killed by the cost of going in and out and the spread.
Yeah.
Transaction costs. I mean, it's how all these companies make their money.
Yeah.
They want to encourage you to churn.
And it goes back to where we started the conversation about the benefits of technology now and the fact that we can trade as often as we like. However, it does involve and does lead to some certain amount of over trading, as you know, I've been at fault of doing it myself.
Now, well, we've all done it.
Yeah,
we've all done it. Anyone who says they've never over traded. I mean, was it Fidelity found their most successful clients were dead? Seriously.
Oh, dear.
Look, about 2011, Fidelity did, in America, another American report, but they did research on who their most successful clients were. And they were either people who'd forgotten they had an account or were dead. Because they didn't touch it and they just let the money grow.
Yeah, that is.
You know, they set the account up as reinvest.
Yeah.
So the dividends were reinvested in shares, or they took a scrip dividend instead of cash in the first place anyway. But yeah, they were, I think Fidelity may have pulled that research, but no, you can find links to it. I think it was about 2011. Fidelity, right. And Citibank did the same. They had, because Citibank has been around for so long, they had research on 60 couples where both the man and the woman had shares in 1945. And between 1945 and 2005, women as a group massively outperformed the men.
Yeah, because they traded far less and left things just sitting in the account.
By and large, those ladies had been given the shares when they got married by their parents. They it was part of their dowry.
Yeah.
We'll go back a few years, 45. But they basically not traded the shares. They had a far higher percentage of companies that completely ceased to exist. But they had just compounded their money over that 60-year period and just done so much better.
That makes perfect sense to me, that does. And it goes back to what you were saying about staying in the market rather than, you know, timing the market again, doesn't it, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's very hard. People do it every time, but I haven't got the skill base to be able to tell anyone, get in on Monday, get out at 3 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, as you've seen on Twitter, there's a few people that think they can do that, time it to the actual, you know, to the minute or the day, which I find absolutely fascinating. Right, Jonathan, if there's one thing you could change regarding the investing landscape, what would it be? What is your thing that you're thinking, I wish that wasn't still happening? Or could be improved, sorry.
Well, I think I find strange is people keep on asking for reform of this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a number of the other people you've had on Congress Corner have said, well, we should change these rules or change those rules.
Yeah.
I kind of think that as a private investor, you've got to be aware of what the market is. And there is no such thing as a perfect world. And you're certainly not going to get it just because you asked for it. So the idea that we should have this reformed or that reformed, if it's a share listed on AIM that does its business in China, what's the chances that it's a fraud? Pretty damn high. And is it really AIM regulation that you're expecting to go and track everyone down and really check that a guy isn't doing something not nefarious in China? You're nuts. Get over it, move on, don't buy the share.
I mean, the thing is, I'm one for every company and every group of companies, regardless of whether from China or another country, should be given the fairness of being able to come in the market. It's our responsibility as shareholders and the LSE, London Stock Exchange, sorry, and the FCA to verify that they're competent and responsible individuals. Now, irrespective of whether they're from China, there are companies on AIM, on FTSE, on the FTSE 250 and the FTSE 100 that have been up to no good, that have been absolute shambolic regarding their due care and attention for shareholders. So it's not just about Chinese companies. I think they've been given a really bad name by, you know, a repeat offenders coming from that country. However, they're just as well British English companies in the FTSE 100 and across the whole of the All Share Index that have let investors down staggeringly. You know, so yeah, we have to do our due diligence, and that's the great thing about some of the work that Mark Bentley and the team, Nigel Lawson, are doing at ShareSog. We need to have more rights, and we need to be more diligent. And certain things could be changed, but should we exclude Chinese companies from AIM or from the FTSE? I don't think so.
Whether you want to pick Chinese companies, many of these companies have got directors who are serial offenders. UK AIM companies.
Yeah.
It was not about Chinese. My point was about, as a private investor, you need to get into this with your eyes wide open.
Completely agree, yeah.
If a guy has run a crooked business before, he's probably a crook.
he's likely to offend again, should we say. More polite and say that, yeah, okay.
Yeah, if a guy's run a very dodgy PLC, not using any particular letters, starting letter was Q or something, and then you go to another business. Don't, for God's sake, think that at the next business he's the saint.
That's why
I look for 3 years accounts, because I think it's very hard to fake numbers for 3 years. But then if you start reading it, and they've gone and bought this business, which isn't very related, and this business that isn't very related, and this business, which has an asset of a quid that they've paid £1 million for.
Yeah.
All that sort of stuff. Don't buy it.
Yeah.
Don't sit there and think, oh, but they say it's going to be great, all right, on the night.
Yeah.
It would be lovely to think that mass reform of the laws or better implementation of that or anything, but you know, if you want the FCA to go and do something, well, they've probably got to go to, they've got to travel to all these businesses, which means somebody's got to pay for it.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to pay for it. You know, you don't want to, every time you do a transaction to be charged £100 with £90 of that going to support the FCA.
Yeah.
So the reality is you either say people have to be aware of what they're doing and go in with their eyes wide open, or you ask for more regulation. But, right, we're early where we started, Enron.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's not the regulation. It's how people choose to apply. There's always going to be a guy looking for the loophole.
Loophole, yeah.
No, and no. Sarah's saying, well, I've written a law and now I can do something different. Mm-hmm. No.
No, no. I get the point that you're trying to make. No, I think that's a valid point. And I think, unfortunately, that, and we've all been there. We've been newbies, as we politely call them. And some of us have got a few more years under our belts now. But it's easy, I think, for people to be influenced by certain companies, spin doctors, and the wording of what they've said and what they claim they've got, and these blue sky investment opportunities, which invariably 99% of them do not actually materialise. And a lot of these companies come and go, as we've seen from the dot-com days. A lot of those companies don't exist anymore. But there's a lot of blue sky stocks on the FTSE, and also on AIM that will never ever make a profit. So, and equally, there's the talk now about this, what they're calling unicorns, where, you know, companies that are unlisted are already worth $1 billion and they haven't got a revenue stream, but they've got a great idea.
Yeah. It's one in the States at the moment, isn't it, where it turns out that they've been doing tests on people.
Yeah. Theranos, the lady. Yeah. Theranos, yeah.
Yeah, and is it Ella Holmes?
Yeah, Elizabeth Holmes, Theranos. Yeah.
Turns out they never had the licenses for half of what they were offering.
Yeah.
And the tests that they do don't actually work.
Yeah. It's a bit of an embarrassment for the exchanges over in the US.
No, there's some grown-up investors who've got into that.
Yeah. I mean, some large institutional funds got into that, mate, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's some real money behind that. But at the end of the day, you've got to do your own research. And you've got to say, well, actually, this is why I understand, this is why I'm doing it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Regulation will only take you so far.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Right. Jonathan, I've got two more questions, mate. Right. And then we're going to just have a little quick chat about some other things, because we haven't really touched on the biggie, the elephant in the room as yet. this is turning into quite a long one. I'm glad you're being patient with me here. Right. If you were starting out today in investing, Jonathan, what would you do that you had not considered or unable to do back when you were 16, 17?
There's vastly more information easily available.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first started investing, you had to buy, well, you didn't have to buy, you could borrow it from the library. You basically buy a book of accounts. Mm-hmm. Which were little traces of every business.
Yeah.
You know, there was no internet. Yeah. My first working job, I had a Luggable.
Say that again, sorry.
My first job as an accountant,
yeah,
we had Luggables.
Right, that's what I'm saying. What is a Luggable? Sorry.
And you used to lug them. They were called Luggables because they were so heavy.
Right.
They're basically the size of a suitcase. And then the screen the size, not much bigger than a cigarette packet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all heavy processing. And you used to just about do spreadsheets on it. So there's just so much more information out there, both in easy access to accounts, in access to people's opinions, and there's so much free information out there.
Yeah.
That investing is a lifelong learning business.
Agreed.
And the people who don't take that opportunity are just shooting themselves in the foot. And it's just all out there for free.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, an hour spent improving yourself is a fantastic investment.
Yeah, I heartily agree on that, mate, because I love my books, and as you know, and there's the opportunity there to learn more and more. And, you know, everyone's learning every single day that wants to learn. You know, and others just want to remain ignorant. That's their choice.
So a lot of the lessons I learned by doing something stupid, I could have probably learned by reading it.
Mm.
But that was not as easily available as it is today.
It is today, yeah, agreed.
And so that's the big difference, just the sheer weight of information. And you can go on, you know, SharePad or ShareScope, Stockopedia, all these things, and just pull out data, and do you think, oh, I understand what that means now.
Mm,
yeah. I like the way that looks. I'll be interested in buying some of that. Or not holding some of that.
This looks like
a pig. I'm running a mile.
Yeah, indeed.
You know, Wheelie Dealer with his Wheelie bin.
Yes, yeah.
Just stick it in there.
Yeah, no, he's a good lad. Love Wheelie. Now, Jonathan, given all that you you know now, yeah, and having the accounting edge, being able to go down into the minutiae of detail regarding accounts, yeah. What do you, in your opinion, think is the best kept secret to investing? Excluding all the other comments that you've made thus far, just an add-on, please.
If I know it, it's not a secret.
No. There are nubs in there, and every single thing that you've learned, you think, ha-ha, I'm always going to use that now, or is it always going to have this as part of my armoury?
I think no matter, whilst I there's so much more information, and it's so readily accessible to so many people.
Yeah.
As a small private investor, you can turn over rocks and find gold underneath.
Yeah.
PPHE, case in point.
Yeah.
I can't remember why I first started looking at it. I'm sure it may be just I was turning over rocks, or it may be somebody said, you know, I read an article that said, actually, there's this company called PPHE. It's worth looking at.
Yeah.
There's just a vast range of stuff out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I got into it, it may not be true now. I mean, I still think it's worth a bit more than it is, but that's just an opinion. But when I got into it, it was so obviously undervalued. And people don't need to follow stories. Now, if you want 1,000% returns, then you've got to come up with a brilliant statement. But the market at the moment, it's hard to, there's very few people going to make 10% this year. That's the reality of the market. So people need to understand that they're not in a market where guys who routinely claim, I made 30 year after year after year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody does.
Yeah.
Not really. So you've got to be aware of what you can, kind of what's sensible to do in the current market. But once you've done that, there is gold to be had, provided you're prepared to turn over a number of stones.
Yeah.
And until you've found that gold, don't do anything.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for searching amongst under-researched stocks. You know, and if you can find them before the herd arrives, you know, or the city or the papers arrive, then, you know, you can wait and just wait your turn. And eventually, when the herd arrives, they'll be the catalyst for the stock for you. And you can sit back and go, mm-hmm, okay, thank you, guys, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and the last thing I wanted to touch on, and we're going to have to make this short and sweet, really, because we've been on here for a little while now, is the EU ref Brexit and how you think, you know, being a businessman that covers, you know, you're bouncing across from one EU country to another. How do you think it's going to impact business going forward? What do you think potentially are the benefits of being in a situation whereby we're away from the EU, etc.?
There are a lot of very bright people who've looked at the numbers and said this is going to decrease the value of the UK. And I think that, you know, maybe they're wrong. Who knows? I mean, predicting the future is difficult at the best of times. But I think overall, this is one of those things that some people's lives are going to be better. And I think that's one of the features of Brexit is some people's lives are going to be a lot better. Yeah. After Brexit, some people are going to see very little difference. But on the whole, I think a number of people's lives are going to be made much tougher.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you've got just sort of, not a great example, but if you say GDP is 100 and you've got 10 people making 10. If GDP goes down to 94, which isn't a big difference, or 96, say it goes down to 96, which is a 4% decline. But at one end, you'll have a guy who's making 10 today, but he'll do something clever. He'll invent the new biotech or computer system or whatever. And he goes up to 20. And the next guy along goes up to 15. And then you've got a couple of guys who move to 11 because they've got more successful or whatever.
Yeah.
But when you start adding up at the front, then you have some guys in the middle who stay at 10. Then you'll get one or two guys who are down at 9 whose lives are a little bit less fun. But when you do the math, the guys at the end in position 9 and 10, they've only got 2 left. You know, and they will have a massive fall in their lifestyle. Who they are, I can't tell you. You know, which businesses will really benefit from all these changes?
Yeah.
Until the laws are written, we don't know. I mean, financial services probably isn't, you know. If you're a euro bond trader, I'd be brushing up on my French and German.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, guys, for those people, if you're Nissan, do you want to keep your, are you going to put the next model into Sunderland?
Yes, a very good
or
point.
Or you're
going to
put the next bottle into the plant in Spain.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I don't know. I have no idea what Nissan's going to do. So, like all these things, we've taken this big jump. Most of it, for many of us, will some of it will be positive. I think that's probably true. For many of us, a lot of it we won't notice. And, but for some people, that then they've had their lives ruined.
Yeah, yeah, would appear to be the case. Very, 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 very much so. And some industries are going to be impacted significantly, you know, including the farmers, those in Wales that have been massive EU subsidies as well. You know, it's going to be.
There's some farmers who will do really well out of it. I'm sure. You know, if you're running a large commercial farm, there's a good chance that actually you can produce something that. You know, at the moment you're having to operate under EU laws. If you're running a large commercial farm in Berkshire, you're probably able to knock down a few because you're paid to keep up hedges and things like that. You can turn it into a much bigger field, run your combines and your ploughs down efficiently, put chemicals on it that you're probably not allowed under EU regulations.
Yeah.
Good to go.
Okay.
If you're a subsidised Welsh Hill farmer, you know, things are not so good.
Yeah.
And it depends what you want. I mean, you know, the EU... That's the question. Is the British government going to replace? There's EU grants for things like having hedges, as I understand it. If you're a farmer, for not having big fields but making the countryside look nice, there's a grant for that. Will the government take some of the tax money it's got? It's going to get from, and put that towards those grants, or is it going to say, well, actually, we need to put the money in the NHS?
Yeah.
Does the look of the fields of the UK really concern you? You know, at the end of the day, there's so many unknowns.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and that's basically why the markets got spooked on the Friday morning of the 24th and got absolutely, you know, sorry, the Friday after the Brexit vote and got absolutely smashed to smithereens. And everyone was saying the end is nigh. Yet yesterday, the FTSE hit, you know, an 11-month high. And today, with less uncertainty because Theresa May's now in place and... she's sorted out her cabinet. The pound has now spiked to a two-week high. You know, so it's essentially we're almost not saying everything's back to where it was, but the uncertainty's gone. So people are now thinking, okay, they may have a strategy, they may even have a plan going forward to deal with the ramifications of the vote and the Brexit vote. So, you know, it's going to take a little while before we all know. The Leavers are already complaining. The Remainers are up in arms. You know, so it's got a long way to go yet, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and people do a lot of different things. As an investor, what's our role as an investor? An investor, our role is to try and profit from it.
True.
So, you know, as an investor, you're thinking, well, you know, whether you're a Leaver or a Remainer, as an investor, we are where we are. I mean, unless you know, Theresa May has decided we're going for it. She supported Boris Johnson, who's insulted just about everybody at some stage.
Yeah.
David Davis, the man who was regarded as too lazy to run the Conservative Party.
Yeah.
And Liam Fox, the guy who makes the right wing look left wing.
I don't go down the line of this, mate, John, because we could be here for another hour, and the political side of this cabinet today. I would have to have you on for another podcast, mate, because we would chew the fat for another hour and a half. But it is, I mean, let's just pick up on the Boris bit and the insults he's given to various people. You know, all right, Obama's not got long left in office, but he's also insulted Hillary Clinton. And, you know, he's going to have to sit in a room with her at some point and say, what? Is he going to start off with every foreign ambassador and every foreign leader and say, you know what? I really apologise for what I said back in this date and that date. You can't open the door with that as his first opening gambit to start negotiations with everybody. It's just staggering, really. And the question was, had it not been Boris, who would it have been?
Well,
you know, because it had to be one of the Leavers, and it wasn't many other Leavers in the cabinet that had that sort of, you know, status as somebody who's got a good and a large following, really.
I don't know. Does the rest of the world know who Boris Johnson is?
Oh, I think they do, but they think he's a comedy character. That's the problem.
Well, you know, in the end, I don't know. That's the reality of the situation. I don't know what the world thinks about these people. I mean, I lived abroad. I lived abroad for a number of years out in Asia. And by and large, they didn't care about the UK.
Yeah.
I mean, you got a fair amount of UK news in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
A fair amount, less and less. But in places like Singapore and the Philippines and Japan, they'll know Theresa May's the Prime Minister. They've got that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we weren't that important to them. We weren't a big deal on their desk.
Okay.
And so the UK, we're the world's fifth biggest economy now, sixth. You know, we've fallen behind France after Brexit.
I think we're sixth, yeah.
Yeah. We represent 6% of the world economy. If we go down by 33, you know, by a third, we're down to four. So it's a 2% of the world economy change.
Yeah.
And I don't think we'll go down by a third. Please God.
No. I hope not. I mean, there were some stats last week about the fact that we've underperformed Argentina recently. I was like, oh, there you go. You know, and prior to being in the EU, we were staggeringly low sort of GDP growth, and then, you know, over the years of being in the EU, we'd climbed and climbed and done really, really well. And my concern is, where is the growth going to come from if we're a service-led industry, and predominantly our services are with EU countries? How does the country grow?
Oh yeah, I think there are all sorts of issues, but we are where we are.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a private investor, you've got to look to try and profit from it.
Yeah, we've got to be nimble. I appreciate this.
And as a, you know, human being, you've got to decide, is this really the country where you want to bring your children up?
Yeah, and it would appear that lots of people are asking that question. Now Jonathan, I've covered all my questions. I just wanted to ask you if there's anything that you wanted to cover that we hadn't covered, that you wanted to raise regarding investing long term. You know, we have not touched on compounding, and I know that's something that you like to look at as well regarding reinvesting your dividends on certain stocks that do pay you a nice yield. Is there anything you wanted to cover or say that we've not covered?
There's two things.
Yeah, go.
I might add. One is on dividends. There's an amount of research that says if you look at how to make real money over a period of time, for a lot of people, dividends are a very good way to go. Capital appreciation in your stock is no bad thing.
Yep,
but a lot of people, if you can get a decent yield, 3, 4, 5, 6%, and you can certainly get that on a lot of stocks today. If you can get a decent yield on your stock, that's, you know, rule of 72, you can make a very good return over a, you know, relatively short period of time, and the capital gain then becomes a benefit on top of that.
Indeed.
And that's worth thinking about. The only other thing I would say is, whatever people choose to do and how they choose to do it, you have to sleep at night. If doing this is keeping you awake, or the way you invest is keeping you awake, keeping you worried, keeping you looking at the screen, biting your nose, it's just not the thing to be doing.
Agreed, yeah.
You've got to be able to sleep at night, kiss your wife, look after your kids, and go and do that, because that is more important.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I mean, why do you invest? I mean, partially it's more is great. You know, more money is no bad thing. You know, it's all very well saying wealth doesn't buy you happiness, but it buys you a damn sight better level of discomfort. But on the other hand, as you get older, there is some truth in the statement that it's, you know, people start saying, well, what time have you spent with the children? What time have you spent with the wife? What experiences have you enjoyed? And if investing is causing you to be concerned or annoyed when you get home and panics and all that sort of stuff, you know, every day you can have a bad day, but if over the longer term it's causing you to be upset, then you're probably doing it wrong.
Yeah, or you're over leveraged. Yeah no, that's, I mean, great points. That is,
you know, you've got to be able to sleep at night. If markets will move and some people will panic, but if you can't sleep for two nights in a row, you really got to look at your approach. Because nobody should be that upset or that worried by it.
No, that's great points, mate. I'm glad you've added those two points there. We've covered all the different issues that I wanted to talk to you about, and I really appreciate you giving up your time, Jonathan. I appreciate you. We've been on here for a good hour now and a bit more. And I really appreciate the fact that you've shared some articles with LSE Share Talk in the past as well, and look forward to working with you more so in Share Talk in the past as well, and look forward to working with you more so in the future. And if there's anything that we can do on, you know, and on your behalf, then please let us know. But I'm really, really, really glad that you took the time out. I know you've been busy running backwards and forwards in various countries over the last couple of weeks. So I want to say thank you ever so much. We'll be publishing this in a couple of weeks' time, and we'll stick it out there. And in the meantime, just please keep in touch and keep sharing your work with the Twitterati, as we call them. And I look forward to speaking and meeting with you again in the future, mate.
And you.
All right then, mate. No, that's been great, Jonathan. I really appreciate it, mate. You take care, and keep tweeting, mate. Don't let the people that are takers just take. You know, just be yourself.
Yeah, you can only be yourself.
Yeah. Okay, mate. Thank you, Jonathan. Take care. God bless. Bye for now.
Okay. Bye bye.